All right, let's pray out. Amen. Let's give Beanie another round of applause. Okay, so that was a good warm up. Anyway, it gives me great pleasure to introduce our next speaker. This guy saw me bounce in and out of here for a while, and he's a younger cat. Really admire his walk and sobriety and the things that he's accomplished in his life. And it gives me great pleasure to introduce our main speaker tonight, Evan Smart. Evan Alcoholic. How you doing? Pretty nervous. Guys, I can't lie. You know, when Glenn asked me to be the main speaker, I was thinking, gosh, you know, I remember all like the circuit type speakers that I listened to and how mind-blowing their story was, and I was thinking about all those things, and I thought, that's not going to be mine. and that's okay. You know, that's okay that my story really isn't, it really isn't anything that's mind-blowing, and it doesn't have to be. You know, what it was a very low point in my life, one that was pretty unescapable. I got to be honest. You know, I don't know how I escaped, but it wouldn't have happened without Alcoholics Anonymous. It was just no question. And I'll go through my story and I'll tell you all the places I had to go to before here, but if there's anything you hear tonight, just as a preface, Alcoholics Anonymous worked where other things didn't, and I'm sober today because of that. And if I wasn't willing at one point to try this program, I honestly don't think I'd be standing here. Not just up there, but I don't think I'd be alive. And I think if I were to distill anything down just ahead of time, that would be it. You know, please give this program a try. You know, if you're new or if you're struggling, you know, please pray for willingness if you pray for nothing else. And for me, I had to be broken down to be willing. I wasn't willing because I was smart. I wasn't willing because I had some kind of ulterior motive that was going to be good. I was willing only because I had nothing else but death waiting for me. I mean, and that's just my story. Other people were a lot more functioning than I was, and I had to find that out. A lot of people came from a lot of different backgrounds than I did, and I found that out. And those are things that Alcoholics Anonymous exposes you to right away. You realize that you're not unique, and you know your story isn't unique, but there's also a lot of differences in other people's story as well. So you find out you're just in this mixed mash of people just trying to get sober, and that's what makes it special. Thank you, Vinny, for leading off. I asked Vinny to come pitch a couple innings for me, and I'm really glad you're able to do that, and I really appreciated what you had to say. It was really good, especially if you're talking about going through your mind. I'm young. Can't I go back out there and do this again? Is it really that bad? Well, that doesn't ever really stop. I got to be honest with you. I still have those same thoughts. Even after 9 years of recovery, I still think to myself, man, I was young. I can go back out there and drink again. I can go back out there and do this again. I clearly just wasn't ready for that. You know, my mind still tells me scary things like that, and that's why you have to stay connected. You have to stay connected because your mind never stops being an alcoholic mind. Your character defects continue to try to escape you and influence your actions. And Alcoholics Anonymous is a way for you to come in and realize, oh no, there's nothing better out there for me. That I see, and unfortunately people do go back out, and that's the main lesson for us who haven't done it yet, is to learn from their mistakes and to learn from their story. And I'm here to give you my story because hopefully maybe one of you might relate to something I say. So, alright, start at the beginning. I grew up in a family of four brothers, and they're not all, that some of them are half. I have a stepbrother. It's a big, long, mixed family relationship. It was a pretty solid family. And a lot of people come in here, and they have alcoholics all through their chain, and they're exposed to Alcoholics Anonymous well before they even become develop a drinking habit of their own. Not my family. My family didn't have those issues. I didn't know what AA was outside of the movie, depicting a meeting. I didn't know what that was. And that really made it hard for my family to grapple with the things I was doing because it was so self-destructive and it was so foreign to them. There wasn't any sympathy for it, to be honest with you. You know, I'm not saying I had it rough at all by any means, because people who have alcoholic parents, they get the shit in, to be honest with you. But at least when you turn out that way, people see it. My family, people are just like, what's wrong with this kid? What's wrong with this kid? It was so self-destructive, and it started at such a young age, and not so much the drinking and the using. Some people drink and use way earlier than I did, but how quickly my life fell apart was so young that everybody looked at me like I was stupid or something. Were you stupid or something? You know? And I people tell me, are you stupid or something? What's wrong with you? And honestly, I never was able to answer that question for a lot of years. But I was really hooked into sports in junior high, and I'm going to start there. Junior high, I love sports, like basketball, baseball, football, and I was a starter on all the teams, and it was my life. I really had a lot of fun doing that. That was my outlet in life. And, you know, I'm not going to say I was a cool kid. I was never a cool kid. Nobody would ever call me that. But I had that. I had sports, you know. Whatever I was at that age, going through that age, I knew I could go to practice, I knew I could meet friends that way, and I had some kind of life outside of going to school and going home and sports, and I really thought, and I was a big kid. I was a big kid, and that certainly aided in my ability to play in athletics, so I was all into that. And then I got into high school, and then, you know, there's kids smoking weed, kids drinking. High school. And I had a very best friend, my absolute best friend in the world. His name is Daniel. He played football with me. And one day I went over to his home, and he and his buddies were smoking some weed. And I was such good friends with Daniel, and honestly I was always of the mindset, you know, I'm willing to try something new, you know. But I didn't want anybody to know, even at that time, that this was new to me. I told him, yeah, man, I smoke a bunch of times, right? I can manage. And I did. We passed that shit around all night. And I had no idea what I was doing, but, you know, I had a great time. And then I smoked it again the next morning. And that's when it really hit me. I didn't realize at that time in my life that if you do something the first time, it doesn't always work exactly the way it's supposed to work. The time I did it, the next day again with him, after all his buddies had gone home. Oh, man. It was ecstasy. Not literally, but it was my buddy. And I got to tell you, a lot of people would have just left it at that. A lot of alcoholics would have left it at that. I'm telling you, from that was the moment in my life where everything changed. And you know, smoking pot in high school is in freshman year or whatever, you know, is completely normal. It really is in our culture. It's completely normal. But it changed my life forever. Because when I felt that, I knew something like that existed. And I was so all in. Like, here's my chips. All in. I never felt or experienced anything like that before in my life. Sports were nothing compared to that. The wild stuff that me and my buddies did, you know, because we always were trying to get in trouble, and the sober trouble, where we go out and get in trouble, do stupid stuff, none of those thrills compared to that. It was the end of an era. Sports Evan is done. I continued to play sports, but they wouldn't let me on the team after a while because I was such a screw-up, because it was completely supplanted by drugs and alcohol. Now, I'm not going to go too much into drugs, and I did a lot of drugs, and it has a huge part of why my story ended the way it did. But I smoked weed for the first time, and that was the introductory thing for me. And I'm just going to leave it at that. But once that happened, I didn't just go home and say, hey man, that was fun, let's do it again. I was thinking, I want to know where you're getting it. I want to know when you're smoking it again. I want to know everything there is to know about it. I want to know where you buy the stuff. And honestly, of course, I couldn't have known this at the time, and at the age I was, I couldn't have known that that was just how my mind worked. I had no idea, you know? But I'm an all-or-nothing kind of mind, to a fatal degree. And I was immediately out of basketball. Done. I started drinking because my buddies and I, we started going and stealing stuff after school. I had a huge sticky finger, or sticky hands. I would go out every day after school, before I'd come home, and I'd go out and I'd steal liquor from all the stores in town. To the point where I'd have my trunk full of bottles of liquor. And you know, I mean, when you're 15 or 16 or whatever, you can't go out and buy it, and I wasn't willing to part with my money. I was just such a seek for thrills that the stealing was as much of a high for me as the drink was. But I wanted to have the drink because not only did that provide me the liquor I needed to get drunk every day, people were buying it from me. I was drunk in my car. I was selling to the kids who couldn't have anybody in that, and then I was my drug money. Boom. And that was my life right away. My grades went down immediately. And it wasn't because I was stupid. It was because I couldn't show up to class. I wasn't just showing up to class inebriated. I came hungover. So I had to drink to get my hangover away. I smoked a bunch of pot to try to make my hangover go away. I'd come over every single day with just a rollover from the day before because it never stopped. It was on, like Donkey Kong. I was on. And it was sad. My friends all changed. My parents' opinion of me changed. And I'm telling you, this isn't a matter of months. A matter of months. This isn't, you know, over the course of high school. We're still talking like within a matter of months. And it got down to the last sport I was in was football. And why waste a big body? That's really what it had more to do with. It's Evan is still worth the trouble because he's a big and he's fast, you know, and we can't just let guys like that go. You know, so, I mean, I'd like to sit here and tell you I was an all-pro football player, but really I'm just a big kid. And so I got to stay in football. And I thought to myself, that's all me. That's really, it really was. It was just something that I was basically given to hold on to. Even though every coach tried to help me and knew that I wasn't worth the trouble. But they let me keep that. And I was at St. Joe's when this started. An education that I really wasted on my parents' behalf. You know, it wasn't cheaper than to send me there. I know that now as a parent. I'm thinking, wow. Well, I just blew that away. I blew away that opportunity. And time went on and I crashed my truck. So I was walking. And my parents weren't going to go out and get me in the car. Not with the way I was acting up or the things I was doing. So you know what I did? I said, fine. I'm gonna walk across town. That's what it took, and that's what I did every day. I either had people pick me up or I walked across town and I stole more stuff and I drank myself into oblivion right there on the street. And it got to the point where I had liquor bottles next to my bedstand when I went to bed, and I'd wake up and it would be gone, and I wouldn't know. I wouldn't even remember drinking it. It was so ridiculous how addicted I was and how fast. And of course, I eventually got kicked out of St. Joe's. They finally got enough, not just the sports, but also the administration there. They said, we're done with you kids. We're done. And they kicked me out. And my parents didn't know what to do with me. But the drugging didn't stop and the drinking didn't stop. And it got to the point where I had to go to the hospital to get my stomach pumped because I had no I was sitting there just drinking out of the bottle. And it was unfortunate because it didn't need to be that way. I had friends who were down like I was in high school, and I didn't even want to hang out with them towards the end. I just wanted to sit alone and drink because that's how quickly it was progressing. It was such an exponential rate for me. anyway, I'll cut.
My thumb's up.
Things got really bad when I went over to Rigetti. I did it through independent study. But the football coach for Rigetti came knocking on my door one day. And he came over to talk to my dad, and he said, "Your son just got kicked out of St. Joe's, and I want him to be able to play, want him to play football for us over at Rigetti." And I got to tell you, I was so out of my mind wasted when he was there. I barely remember this meeting. But he came over to my dad, and he said, "I really want your son to play football." And the coach left, and my dad came to me, and I was just immensely wasted. And he came over, and he told me basically what the meeting happened. And he said, "You're going to play." And I said, "I don't want to play." He said, "You're going to play. Someone's giving you an opportunity to play when you don't deserve it." So I went and I played. I went and I played football for Rigetti, and it was a blast. I had a good time. I'm really glad that that happened to me, but things got a whole lot worse. I was there, and I was stealing from my teammates. I was getting caught stealing. I was getting caught stealing out in town by the cops. I've been arrested a few times, been in jail a few times, because I just couldn't stop stealing alcohol. I couldn't stop doing drugs with my friends. And I eventually got to the point where for outside things, I started going to the hospital because I was having close calls with other things, other substances. And it scared the living daylights out of my parents, and it scared me too, actually, at the time. So by the time I was at Hancock, things were really bad, but I decided that I was going to try to stop. I was going to try to do it on my own. So what I did was I white-knuckled it for about 4 or 5 months, and everybody was really proud of me. My life started turning around immediately, actually. To be honest with you, I started doing the right things, started clearing up. And you guys all know what happened next. My alcoholism was doing push-ups for me. It was waiting for me to stop. It was waiting for me to give up. It was waiting for me to get, for things to get hard, for me to go back, and I had nothing to defend it with. And it came back, and it came back with a vengeance. I got down with all the wrong people, and I started doing all the wrong things again. And it got to the point where I was doing things that even my hardcore buddy friends were like, "Ben, what are you doing? What's wrong with you? That's going to kill you if you do that." I mean, my friends were telling me this. And I said, I don't care, man. I really didn't think anything about it. I need to get as far away from who I am as I can. I didn't know how. I didn't know why. I needed to kill whatever that feeling was that came in when you started to sober up. You just start to not feel drunk or high or anything ever again. Whatever that feeling is that creeps into you as it starts to come back, I needed to kill it, and I needed to kill it as fast as I possibly could. You know, I was talking to Billy once, and I told him that it's a lot like being held under a pool, you know, head held underwater, and you're struggling to breathe, and you desperately want to come back up for breath. That's how I was feeling all the time. I felt like that every single minute of every single day until I could get a drink. And then for a minute, I didn't feel like that. And that's just like the kind of urgency I had to get messed up all the time. And I basically got to the point where I was getting arrested, and I was having hospital visits so frequently that my parents didn't know what to do. And I really felt bad for them, and honestly, I feel bad for them now. Honestly, if it weren't for them sticking by me, they could have kicked me out several times, and they never did, because I think they knew what I would do to myself if they had. And my mother was hard-headed in ways that made our relationship very hard. But had she not done that, I might not be standing here. If she had ever been the parent that condoned that kind of thing and let it be open, I don't think I'd be standing here. So 2011 comes by, and I start doing stuff that is just these artificial kind of things that are out there. Some of you know what I'm talking about. And I ended up going to a mental institution in a straitjacket, and they wheeled me in there on a stretcher, and I was sitting there, and everybody was just talking to me like I'm nuts. And I'm sitting there, I'm not crazy. I swear to God, I don't need to be here. And I probably spent the first 3 days telling them that, and I said, listen, until you calm down, until you start doing something, go take a shower, start eating, no one's gonna listen to you. And I eventually got let out of there, but I honestly thought I was going to convince them that I wasn't crazy. And this is it. And I got brought in a straitjacket, you know. And I was 20 years old. I think I had lost my mind using substances for a while. And when I wasn't using, I was drinking liquor right out of the bottle. All in one sitting. There was no amount that I could consume quickly enough to kill the feeling at this point by 20. And I got let out of there, and I quickly gravitated towards the drink because I couldn't get the stuff that got me in there basically anymore. So I quickly gravitated to the drink. And this is 2011, and I basically drank myself into oblivion in a way that I couldn't even go outside without somewhere. I basically bed bound myself there with alcoholism for a while after I got out of it because I was coping so badly with the liquor to get over everything. So eventually I got sent to rehab, and right after my 21st birthday I got sent to rehab in Santa Barbara. And I remember being sent to a meeting. They would ship us to meetings every day down there in Santa Barbara. And I'd go to meetings, and I couldn't even keep my head up. I was basically sitting there drooling in this church in Santa Barbara, and these guys next to me were took pity on me, basically. And they held me up, and they made sure I got through the meeting, and made sure I didn't get lost walking over there. And some jerk off actually called on me when I was sitting there like this. He actually called on me, I guess, to make an example out of me. And the guys, I couldn't even speak. But the guys with me had my back, and they said, this guy, you know, he's not able to participate, basically. They took care of me. And I got out of rehab because the insurance wouldn't cover it. I got halfway through, the insurance said, you know, we're not going to cover the rest of this. So they let me out of there. And I was happy to be out of there. To be honest, it was like a dream come true. I got to leave rehab early. And I remember the guys from the rehab were actually calling my parents' house and saying, look, this kid shouldn't have left. Something bad can happen. You need to make sure he's getting into something else. And they actually cared enough about how I was that they were calling my parents in Santa Maria and saying, listen, please try to get your kid enrolled in something else. But the truth is, I didn't want to be there. Even after all the pain and after all the suffering, all the relationships that I had burned and all the places I had been at this point, I mean, I had been to jail multiple times. I had now been in an institution. I had now been to rehab. I didn't want it. I rejected it at every turn. So I came home and I started drinking myself into oblivion again, and I was actually taking some classes at CLEPSA. And I drank a handle of Jägermeister that morning. And I got a DUI because I crashed my car and I blew a .4. It was the biggest the judge had ever seen at that point. And I ended up going back to jail. And this was in January. I ended up having to go back to jail in June. And that date's important because I didn't get sober until May. Then that happened in January of 2012. And the car I had again these years later, wrecked, number two now, if you can count. And I basically have hit rock bottom. I don't want to say I ever didn't want to live, but I certainly didn't want to live like that anymore. I wouldn't say that I was a person who wanted to kill himself, but I knew that if I had just kept going, it was going to happen. I was going to die. And strangely enough, that was going to be okay for me. for it to happen. And I want to get out of the somber part and get into recovery. but there's a little bit more. I finally cornered myself, and even after that DUI, and even after that close scare, because that crash could have been really bad, and I could have killed somebody else, but I didn't kill me or anybody else. Thank God. Thank God for that every day. But May comes rolling around, and I'm still drinking, and I'm still using to copious amounts. I finally was taking myself out of whatever school I was in at that point, whatever classes I was taking, I finally took myself out of them. I got to the point, because I had gotten to the point at school where I was going to Hancock, was getting dropped off because I no longer had a car, and I would walk down the street and take liquor bottles and anything else I could, and I'd come back to Hancock, and I would drink in the bathroom stalls, which was not a new move for me. Bathroom stalls were a constant places where I'd get messed up. And I'd sit there and I'd drink in the bathroom stalls, and if I couldn't finish it, I'd go put it in the liner of the trash can, because no one's going to look in the trash can, and I'd come back later and I'd finish it. It had really gotten to the point where I had no shame anymore, you know, and I started blacking out to the point where I couldn't remember things I said. I couldn't remember things I'd done. All I know is I was still up and ambulatory while I was blacked out. I was doing all kinds of things in my life that I had no idea what I was doing. And I finally got to the point where I had consumed some other substances with alcohol, and I went into I don't want to say cardiac arrest, that probably isn't accurate, but I got to the point where my heart was about to come out of my throat. And the ambulance came and got me from my parents' house, and they took me back to the hospital. And that was the last night I ever did anything. That was May 16th, 2012. That's Friday day, May 17th, 2012. And finally, everything had gone white. I couldn't see anything but white, like a movie, just white. And my heart was coming out of my chest, and I remember saying, please, God, don't let me die. And I didn't believe in God. That's just what I told everybody. I said, please, God, don't let me die. The next morning, my brain, I thought, was going to come out of my skull, because I really think it was pushing up against the sides. I had finally gotten to the point where my body couldn't do it anymore. I hadn't gone pee in days because my kidneys weren't working anymore. So when I tell you I came in here early, it's because I really did a lot of drinking all in short period. Anyway, Randy Rose, some of you may know him, he came over to me, and he took an interest in me, and he invited me over to his house, and I asked him to be my sponsor. And I told Randy, I don't think I can do this. I told him that several times, but he said, you can do it. Just come over here. Play board games. Play poker. I didn't know how to play poker. I didn't know how to play any of the board games. But they had me over every single night. And every single night I went to play board games. And every single night I played cards. And I was a very meek person at that time because I was just shocked. And they had me over, and all of a sudden I began to realize I could have a good time with these people. I can let my guard down with these people. And I eventually did. And we sit there and we play every single night, and we make fun of each other. We do whatever we want. And we sit there and we smoke cigarettes till 3 in the morning and play cards. And guess what? It was exactly where I needed to be. I wasn't employable. I certainly wasn't a relationship quality. but I was good enough for you guys. I was good enough for alcoholics. And they had me over there every single night. And eventually I started to piece together a little bit of time. And this is mid-2012. And like I said, June, I had about a month. And Randy knew that I had to go to jail for the DUI. And I couldn't get away with one of the little things or, you know, in your car. I tried to get the ankle bracelet, but I had so many priors that said, no, in order to do that, you're going to have to pay a large sum of money. And I couldn't afford anything, so I was like, I'm just gonna go do whatever time it was. And I wasn't there long because, you know, DUI people are not violent offenders, so I actually wasn't there very long, about a little over a week. But in there,
I convinced myself that I was going to go off to college because I knew that I could get into UCI based off some of the credits I had at Hancock. And I convinced myself that I got this. Not that I wanted to leave AA. I was like, I'm just going to go down there and connect an AA down there, and I'll be okay. And I had my little AA book, big book there with me, and the little cot in the top cell, or the top bunk in jail. And I sat there and I was like, I can do this down there. And I got out, and the alcoholic I was with convinced me, strongly convinced me, that I could not handle that. And I don't know, I was going to go. I told my parents, I'm going to go. And they were like, cool, go. Cool, go. How old are you? You shouldn't even be living here anymore. Go. And against my parents' judgment, against my own judgment, I had young alcoholics, not the older ones. The young ones were like, no, Evan, you're going to get loaded if you go down there. It basically can be your doom. You're going to go down there to college with a bunch of kids who, that's what they're experiencing your life for the very first time down there. They're doing this stuff for fun, and you're not going to be able to resist. And they were right. And I don't know why I listened, but I did. And I didn't go back to school until I had 2 years sober. And that's a long time to take off school, because if you know, if you take any serious time off of school, you may not ever go back. And that's what my dad was afraid of. He's like, you can go to college and get your degree, blah, 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 blah. If you stop now, you'll never go back. And, and there was a time there where I thought about not going back. But I'm forever grateful that the alcoholics talked me out of that. And Randy actually sat down with my dad. He actually sat down with my dad and said, Andy, who's my dad, and he said, your son can't go. If he goes, he will get loaded down there, and he will likely die. He told me that. And then my dad, actually, I think in his heart, knew that that was true. So he said, all right, I'm not going to force him to go. We'll see how this variety thing goes, see how AA goes. Nothing else has worked for this kid, why would AA work? But yeah, fair. And it was fair, and so I had my parents' support to stay. And then a wonderful thing happened. I met my wife at 6 months. I didn't know she was my wife at the time, but she had brought her mother in, and I had a relationship probably a little too soon in sobriety. Okay, 6 months is not, or is a little too soon. But my relationship with Caitlin was also another thing that really helped keep me grounded, because it wasn't just me anymore. It was me and Caitlin. And Caitlin could sense when I was going off the deep end a little bit. And it was nice to have somebody, a relationship in my life, who understood sobriety. Her family had come in here. She knew Alcoholics Anonymous probably better than I did at that point. And having that relationship with somebody who knew, who wasn't an alcoholic, but who knew, was instrumental for me. Because I didn't need to explain why. Now, she's never seen me take a drink, but she knows how crazy I am. And basically, I developed this relationship with Caitlin, and I got to a point where I had 2 years in recovery. I had wonderful friends in this program. I had some ease and comfort in my life from the fellowship, and I finally developed a sense of spirituality that I had never had before. When I walked in here, I had nothing. I had no relationship with God. I had no relationship with Group of Drunks. But I started with Group of Drunks, and I started to work the steps with Randy, and I got to my fourth and fifth step, and all of a sudden, my life started getting easier. I started reaping the benefits of this program, the ones that they talk about in the promises. I had alcoholics give me jobs. I didn't even ask. They said, Evan, do you need a job? And I was like, yeah, I do. And I started, they actually solicited me for the work. And again, I worked with Andrew in the handyman company he worked for a long time, for the 2 years that I was here before I moved away. And I was able to pay my dad back for all the debt. He was paying all this poor stuff and all the DUI stuff for me because I was crap. And I was able to pay him back for that in sobriety, and it gave me a sense of accomplishment for the first time in my life.
Everything in my life had fallen apart since I started touching drugs and alcohol, and it was finally starting to gel back together. And now, it wasn't anything that I did. I was just doing what I was told. I said, Evan, work the steps with your program. Develop some kind of God in your life. And it was a group of drunks, and thankfully today it's more than that. But at the time, that's what I needed. I said, I need the power of these rooms to influence me in ways that I can't do on my own. Some group that's looking out for me, that looking out for the behaviors that I'm exhibiting that I can't catch myself. And the program's steps and traditions, for that matter, I started getting involved with groups at their personal homes. I started using the 12 and 12. I started using the big book for the first time. I wasn't just coming to meetings and sharing about things that I thought. I was actually doing the program, and my life started to turn around. And I got about 2 years into my recovery. Caitlin and I had been together a while. Caitlin had also wanted to go to UCI where I was going, and said, well, why don't we move down? So we moved down. And things got hard really quickly. Not because of my sobriety, but because this is when things in recovery start to hit you. I've had more bad things in my life happen to me when I'm sober than I had ever did when I was drinking. My best friend Daniel, my very, very best friend Daniel, shot himself. And he had gone overseas, and he saw some things in Afghanistan that he wouldn't live with, I guess. And he shot me and killed himself. And it was particularly traumatic for me because he had gone to jail, and I was writing him letters. I was talking to him on the phone, and I was reconnecting with him. And I was trying to convey to him, I said, Daniel, my life is turning around. I feel like I can do this now. I'm off at college. I know I'm a little older, and I know it's not some glorious college that I'm going to, but I'm off doing it, man. It's good. You can do it too, and I know you're going through a rough patch. And his girlfriend called me after this conversation, and his girlfriend said, Daniel, I can't find him. I don't know where he is. I said, I'm sure he's okay. You know, I talked her through it, and I didn't really know her very well, but she's freaking out. And the next thing I know, I'm getting a call saying, yeah, we found Daniel's body. He's taken his life. And we were there in our first Irvine apartment. We hadn't been there very long. And I knew that was one of the first times in AA that I had actually cried. You know, I don't cry a lot. But when Daniel died, I cried. Because there was a part of that relationship that was tied to everything in my life. Pre-using and drinking. All my years drinking and using. And he was part of my life there at the end where I was trying to talk about AA with him. Everything in my life, I could tie back to him because we had gone through it together. And I wish the things then ended the way they did for Daniel. But what his death really was, it was the first test that God gave me to recover. Now, I had known alcoholics in here who had died. I'd sit right next to some people who I found out the next day had overdosed. Stuff like that happens all the time in here. We walk over bodies in here. I knew all that. But Daniel was the first one that was my friend. And he took his life, and I was tested, but I got through it. And the reason why is I had Alcoholics Anonymous there with me. I had meetings I was going to down there. I came back up here, and I went to meetings here. I came and I saw his dad, who still lives here in town, still very good friends with him. And I went through that whole process within 2 years, and I did it by working the steps. I did it by connecting with AA. I stayed very close to AA during that time. And it also happened to be around the same time that my mother got sick. Right after basically wrapping up things, my mother's in the hospital. She's sick. And she had a very long illness that, and she passed away a couple of years ago. That was my next test. How do I repair a relationship with somebody that I decimated? My mother has known nothing but worry and fear and anger with me for so many years. How do I repair that? Well, before I went down, I had made my amends to her. I had did the steps. I had done my amends, and I conveyed to her how important she was to my recovery. And the fact that I'm still grieving has a lot to do with the fact that she never gave in to my crap. She never wanted to take the easy road out with me. That it was easier to hate each other than to let me get away with anything. And I told her all that, That didn't mean our relationship was peachy, you know. But now that she was sick, none of that really seemed to matter anymore because it looked bad, and it was bad. But it gave me a chance to show up and be a son. It gave me a chance to show up and be a positive influence in my family's life. And my dad really went through the ringer with her illness. He really did. Really awful, and I was able to show up. I tell him, if you need me to come up just so you can get out of the house, I will drive 4 or 5 hours. I will sit there for however long you need me to, and then I'll drive back. And he actually called that favor in. I drove up there just so he could get out of the house. And I did it because I could. I wasn't drunk. I wasn't scheming. I wasn't stealing. I didn't want anything from him. I didn't want anything but a chance to be there and to be a part of my family's life in a way that mattered when it was supposed to. And I got that chance. And I was telling some alcoholics before the meeting that, you know, I don't think my relationship with my mother healed the way it would have if she had stayed healthy. But I feel now today that I did everything I could to be the best sober son, the best family member in that situation that I could be. And I can look back today, I can look back for the rest of my life and say I did that sober. And I did that because of the people in this program. Of course, every time I came back up here to check on my mother, check on my dad while I was down at school, I was at these meetings. You guys have seen me at holidays. You've seen me at things. You've seen me the whole time I've been gone. I've gone 6 years. And you saw me because you guys have always been important. Always. And you've always been like family to me because you saw me come in and you saw me bleed. You basically saw my soul on the floor. And I never really had that in Orange County. I had some wonderful people that I know, and I actually walked over some bodies of people I knew down there. It follows you wherever you go. But I never had the connectedness to that group that I have here. And the moment we moved back a year ago, like that, all of you, back in my life, but I hadn't ever been gone. And that's something that you can't replace. That's something that my story is really, I think, is trying to convey to you, is that I've been to all these other institutions, I've been to all these other places, but none of them have that factor. None of them have that relationship, this enduring relationship that keeps me sober through the years, not just for 20 days. I was in law school when my mother passed away. We had our first child in Babylon, and being a father is one of the most special things I'll ever get to do. And I often think about, what if I had had a child when I was the way I was? Can you imagine how damaging, how inflicting that would be on a child like that? And I have heard people talk about their relationships with their kids and what they've done to their kids and people who've had kids in recovery, but it didn't dawn on me until I had my own child that what I would have been to that child would have taken years to undo. Maybe never. But I don't do that today, and she's one of my biggest inspirations and biggest motivations to continue doing what I do, to continue showing up to meetings, to continue doing steps, to continue reaching out, and to continue having a spiritual life. Because if my character defects take a hold of me again, even if it doesn't seem likely, if it does again, even if there's a small chance that they might, it's too big of a chance for me to risk my family over that. So as my sobriety keeps growing, the incentives to stay sober keep growing. As I keep getting delivered the promises, my my responsibilities grow. And there's a responsibility to sobriety that I never understood when I got sober. Is that nobody cares, Evan. No one depends on you when you walk in here. Nobody expects anything of you. Well, now my family depends on me. But the people that my family depends on me, my work depends on me. There's a lot of responsibility now that I have, and it's good because it's all a motivation to stay sober and stay connected. And I want to wrap up by just talking about what I do now. I did recently pass the bar. I'm working as an attorney now. And it's been a long and arduous path to get there. Law school was just part of it. That was very hard. The bar was very hard. I don't want to sit here and say I'm a brainiac and I just made it happen. It's not what happened. I was taking LSAT stuff years before I was even in law school. It's been years in the making to get here. And I'm not saying this to boast. I'm not saying this to say, look at me. I'm saying this because people in this room need to know that it was not achievable without your help. I could not be doing what I'm doing today. I could not be living the way I am and have the opportunities to help people in their legal woes the way I can today without you. You guys are... My productivity in that part of my life, it was born out of your ability to show me how to live. I did not know how to do that. I hope I did a good enough job explaining how broken I was. And for me to turn around and be somebody in the community who's a symbol of putting things back together is mind-blowing to me. So people will come to the firm and they'll say, I need an attorney to help me fix these problems. And I get to do that today. I get to help people with their problems and put things back together when I was only a force of destruction for all of my life up until I got into these rooms. And I just wanted to thank you for giving me that opportunity, for pushing me in that direction. Because I couldn't have a family, couldn't have a wife, I couldn't have a career without you. And I really want to thank you all for that. And I'm gonna end with that. Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming out and sharing your experience and helping us. Let's give Danny and Evan another round.